Cuba Today and U.S.-Cuba Relations. Where do we stand? It was almost 3 years ago, December of 2014, that President Obama took steps to normalize relations with Cuba. But earlier this year, President Trump announced he is reversing some of those measures, most notably rules regarding travel restrictions. Cuba made headlines again when earlier this month, the Trump administration expelled 15 U.S. diplomats from Cuba after several complained of suffering from a sonic attack. Cuba has called the expulsion of the diplomats unjustified and science fiction. As political relations seem to deteriorate, though, cultural relationships between the U.S. and Cuba persist. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will hear a different perspective with Cuban state TV journalist Christina Escobar and Cuban-American poet Richard Blanco. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. When President Obama reestablished full diplomatic relations with Cuba, the hope among many was that there would be a greater flow of tourism, resources, and cooperation between the two nations. Now, 9 months into the Trump administration, the future of the relationship between the two countries is less clear. We're going to discuss today how Cuba is faring and what the outlook for relations is between the U.S. and Cuba. With me today in the studio, Christina Escobar. She's a journalist and well-known anchor for Cuba's state television network. And joining us from a studio in Miami, Richard Blanco, a poet, public speaker, author, and civil engineer, who is also Cuban-American and involved in the organization Cuba One. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you traveled to Cuba since relations opened up? Are you interested in doing business there? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to both of you. And Christina, I'd like to start by having you tell me about life in Cuba today, and especially, what do you believe are some of the biggest misperceptions that people here in the States have about Cuba?
So many.
So many.
That's why I came such a long trip up to here to Maine, and it's a pleasure. I'm so glad to have this opportunity. Well, first, the perception that Cuba is a closed society, that we are restrained from contact with the world because of the problems with the U.S. That's not true. I'm 30 years old. My first lessons of English was with the Backstreet Boys. I watch American television all the time, as well as Cuban television. I feel like a Western journalist, as any other journalist of the world. And we have a relation with a lot of countries in the world. We are a changing country as well, politically evolving, because the generation of leaders of the revolution are getting older and they are stepping down, or in the case of Fidel Castro, who died. And that will mean a political evolution in Cuba. And there are sort of colors of opinions of uncertainty as well, but a lot of doors opening up for the future of Cuba. And I feel very hopeful. I'm a journalist in a country like Cuba who works for public media in Cuba, and I feel tremendously fulfilled of what I do, because I was trained to have a service public, to understand journalism as a service public, as a public service for my country. And in a lot of cases, it's hard to understand that someone young from Cuba has that kind of commitment and the capabilities of doing it and the opportunities of doing it.
Did you grow up in the city or in the country?
In the city, in Havana City.
In Havana. Richard, you travel to Cuba often, recently as part of the organization Cuba One, where you serve on the board. Tell me about the mission of Cuba One and what you are seeing in Cuba as you return again and again.
Sure. I just wanted to echo what Christina said, too, on this side of the 90 miles as well. I think there's a lot of misperception in the United States as if, you know, nobody has gone to Cuba since 1960, you know, when in reality there has been, especially amongst family members, there's been trips and connection with the people of Cuba since the late 70s. So, you know, there's this sense that that Cuba has been cut off from much of the citizens of the United States, but the Cuban Americans here, many with family over there, have had contact. I've gone several times to Cuba. So it isn't like this completely sort of isolated country in some ways. And it is true, as Christina said, that Cuba does have relationships with the rest of the world. So Cuba One, getting to the organization of Cuba One, our fundamental mission, and I work on the advisory board there, is to connect the next generation of Cuban Americans with their heritage, with their Cuban heritage, for several reasons. One is they've had not had access to it as much as I have as a first generation Cuban American. And it's kind of a little harder for them to connect with Cuba. Some of them have family, but they're just very strange family or distant family members. So it's just to sort of reconnect them. The focus is on the arts and in terms of writers, musicians, also using the arts as a catalyst to sort of merge the stories of their equivalent, their counterpart generation in Cuba, and see how that can create a bridge, a dialogue, a new understanding moving forward. And part of it, I feel very strongly, is that, they are the inheritors of the future of U.S.-Cuba relations. And I'm getting old, you know, I'm 49.
That's
so,
not old.
You know, that's part of it. It's passing the baton, passing the baton and just sort of, you know, letting them connect with their heritage and seeing how they continue to evolve their personal relationship, but also the public relationship between Cuba and the United States.
Well, let's talk about that, Richard. You know, you're working with young people in a very deliberate way. Christina, you've just mentioned that you're only 30, quite accomplished for 30, but only 30. What are the differences between the generations in Cuba? What is the difference between the generations and how they see the revolution and how they see the relationship with the United States? Is there a difference?
Of course. For example, my parents, who lived the Bay of Pigs invasion, who lived the very close relation between Cuba and the USSR, and the, let's say, the good years, economically speaking, of standards of life that we had in the 80s. But then when I opened my conscious eyes, it was the 90s. During the 90s, we had the most deep economic crisis that a country in peace has ever lived after the falling of the Soviet Union, what we call the special period, which was a very, very profound economical crisis. And so I grew up in a very austere society with not a lot, with a lot of opportunities for education, for learning, for growing, with healthcare, secure and all of that, but in a very different context, in which, of course, the help of the families in the U.S. was very essential, or even more than it was before. So it's impossible for my generation to develop some kind of hate or some kind of rejection towards the American people or to the Cuban-American community. It's impossible, not only because culturally speaking we are very linked, but because it's part of my everyday life, in music, in consuming television, in news. And, of course, there's a difference. The older generation tend to distrust more the intentions of the U.S. towards my country. And that's understandable. That's why the challenge of giving a different approach towards Obama and all the politicians around him that decided to engage with Cuba in a different perspective. That's why it was so important, the poem that Richard Blanco read that day, August 14, 2015, in that beautiful and hot and sunny summer morning when the opening of the embassy of the U.S. was happening in Havana, as it was so important to see the Cuban flag again in the Cuban embassy in Washington, D.C. All of those things are symbols of an engagement, of a new relation that was starting, that Obama and Raul Castro allowed to happen between our two countries, which shows that we are closer, that we are good people in both sides, and we have a lot to take advantages. But, of course, there's a lot of colors in Cuba, people that distrust more the American intentions towards our country. And what I believe is that closing yourself, rejecting that because you're afraid, only thinking about the bad things of the past, doesn't help you to go to the future. You need to know what happened, but you need to know what might happen and what are the opportunities in the future. And trust more, because there are 2 million Cubans which believe that Cuba is their homeland here in this country. So we're not that far away.
You're talking a lot about the opening of trust after what President Obama did, but we have a different president now.
Yeah, very
and
different.
And how, for example, do your parents talk about President Trump?
You know, with Obama, Obama is extremely popular in Cuba. liked man, politician. He's good with audiences, and the fact that he's humble, that he is African American, that also helps for the Cuban audience. And he was he put in place all the marketing strategy, politically speaking, also in Cuba, and that worked very well. But of course, the conditions are different now. When I entered in journalism in 2014 and entered in this kind of coverage, the challenge was to give a different face of the American politicians. Not everything that comes from Washington is going to be bad for Cuba. There are different faces, different voices. It's not monotone, the perspective on Cuba from Washington. And that was the challenge, clean the face of American politicians so we can trust a little bit more, so we can work together and we can engage in a different relation. But now with this administration, let's say we're going back like 10 years. It's I don't even have to explain as a journalist. I just air what he says, and that will do for the Cuban people. And Richard knows what I'm talking about.
Well, Richard, yeah. I wanted to ask that.
No, we all do. We all do.
Well, on this side of the border, I mean, I think you and Christina both agree that you want stronger and more meaningful relations between the two countries, but the man who's talking in President Trump's ear and encouraging to be tough on Cuba is also, Ted Cruz, is also of Cuban descent. So, Richard, I want to hear your perspective on the generations and the differences within the Cuban-American community.
Sure. And I think there's equivalent counterparts both in Cuba and the U.S., you know, that sort of are sort of tied in the same space. So, of course, the older, like Christina was saying, the older generation, it's the opposite. They mistrust. I mean, and I don't blame them in the sense that, you know, their experiences are their experiences, and I could never speak to for them. But, you know, they are caught in some other space and time. Many of them have never gone back to Cuba. They still sort of don't even know what Cuba is today. But yeah, they're stuck in the mistrust of the Cuban government, whereas the older generation, as Christina was saying, in Cuba has much more mistrust of the U.S. government. So there's a tit for tat on there. And then there's my generation, which is kind of the bridge generation that grew up sort of looking at both sides and looking at history and going, wait a minute, this is a lot more gray than I was led to believe, right? And looking at things more objectively. And then there's the younger generation, perhaps like my nephews, who can barely speak Spanish, but also are a lot more detached. And to them, you know, Fidel Castro is like, who? What? You know, some history figure that happened in the past. And I imagine that the same sort of happens in Cuba in terms of there's a whole generation now that grew up post-USSR. So what I found and what I connect and why I'm with Cuba One is to both give the youth of Cuba and the youth of the United States, the Cuban-American youth here, a connection and a revamping of what their cultural and heritage, cultural roots and Cuban heritage mean together. So there's definitely those equivalents, and that's really interesting to watch. And I think that part of, in my casual conversations with then Chief of Staff, Chief of Mission De Laurentiis, and one of their concerns was, of course, this youth in Cuba that's in some ways is craving very different things. There's a generation gap, and how do you serve the future of the country, right? By giving more opportunities, by connecting with the United States and opening up a different kind of dialogue. So that's been interesting, and that's part of what I feel personally. The youth is the future of the U.S. relations. As far as Trump, I think it's very easy to read that what's happening as he does with everything else in our country, not just with Cuba, it's always reverting back to the old politics of fear and mistrust and, you know, catering to some of the worst parts of our humanity, prejudices, et cetera. And so it's sort of the same card, the same Trump card, when it came to, I think, Cuba relations. It really is for me a shame because I just went to Cuba in July. And I was really starting to feel just really see the effects of what this new relationship meant, and seeing a real change in Cuba in terms of personal prosperity, in terms of just another energy. A lot of people that have been expatriating to Cuba and sort of joining their, you know, a little bit of the, maybe not my, my generation, I think, that had a little more balanced outlook, and sort of rejoining their Cuban brethren and helping each other, helping the Cubans, helping the expats sort of really understand what Cuba is and who they are as Cubans, and the expats sort of, you know, connecting and helping helping the people of Cuba in partnership, collaboration, and in terms of businesses, in terms of thinking about all sorts of ways of moving forward. So it really is. I haven't been to Cuba since the Trump news, since all this has fallen apart. So I'm not sure where it's at now, but I really did start to see something really hopeful happen. And by hopeful, I also don't mean I'm not blind to, you know, I'm, again, my generation is very objective and sort of knows both sides of the stories. And I really did see some very interesting changes that I hadn't seen in Cuba since my first trip. And Cristina, I went, my first trip was 1994. So you can imagine, right in the middle of the special period, though I didn't know any difference. I had a blast because I had nothing to compare it to. So, but I imagine my family, yeah, was going, that was my first introduction to Cuba, which is, so anyway, so yeah, I think that's where we're at.
Cristina, Richard alluded to sort of the most recent news, and I think it's the whole situation with the diplomats and the allegations of sonic attacks, and then President Trump not only removing some diplomats, but then also, you know, kind of insinuating that it was the government in Cuba
saying,
well, it's what did he tweet? What did he say? What did the State Department say? That it's the Cuban government behind it, whereas others in the government have been very careful to say, well, we're not blaming anyone, trying to figure out what's happening. Anyway, I'm just wondering how your newsroom has covered the situation and if you have any idea what happened.
No, by far. I don't have a clue. I'm a neophyte. I don't know a thing. But the expertise, the people that actually researched on that from both sides in Cuba and here, have no clue of what actually happened. Even this week, a big story of Andrea Mitchell in NBC, who she interviewed some of the people in Cuba that are researching on this, is the same conclusion. No source of the attack, no subject. I mean, the person that, or the entity or the government, I don't know, that did the attack, that hasn't exist, the technology for it. So it's actually very irresponsible even calling it an attack, because you don't have the source of that attack. I understand the media, we try to explain what the politicians are saying, and we tend to copy sometimes that word, or I would like to call it more incidents, which I don't deny that exist, and indeed there might be people that might be sick. But the problem is that in all of this, it's been dark. The talk between the two governments haven't been as productive as it should be. And if you want to solve the mystery, you're supposed to work together so that doesn't repeat. So if this actually happened, there's not all the cooperation that should be going on to actually solve this, when the first priority of the U.S. government should be the safety of their own diplomats, as well as is in Cuba, because they were in Cuba. The first country that is interested in solving this is Cuba in the first place. It's easy. It's a political will to engage with the U.S. That's something that Cuba has no benefit in doing this, only damage, because first of all, it gives all these opportunities to bad propaganda for Cuba, which is already happening in the U.S. government. And then always when something like this happens, I always try to find who's benefiting the most from this kind of situation. And the people that are benefiting the most are Marco Rubio, the perspective of the old policy, the failed policy towards Cuba, and of course this perspective that you should shut down Cuba, not allow Americans to go there. And then that's how Cuba is going to change. That's a lie. It's been proven for 50 years that policy doesn't work. So you're going back to a strategy of a defeat again and again. And it's unfortunate. I wish the mystery is going to be solved and no one else gets sick. But because of this, Jennifer, just an idea. This is probably my last trip to the U.S. in a while because of that. Consular services are closed. the staff in the American the embassy is practically the lowest group in years. That means that all of these kind of interchanges that could change so much between our two countries is going to be diminished by far, by even worse than Bush years, which was not exactly peaceful years between our two countries. This situation today is even worse than that.
We have to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Silly's Restaurant in Portland's East End, open at 11 Wednesday through Friday and at 9 for brunch on the weekends, with vegan and gluten-free options. Silly's.com.
The city of Groves, Texas, contracted for heavy trucks to pick up debris from Hurricane Harvey. They came, but when Hurricane Irma hit, the trucks were lured to Florida by the promise of more money.
You've got X number of trucks that spread out for thousands of miles. Pretty much they're going to go to the highest bidder.
I'm Robert Siegel. How the Gulf Coast is coping with hurricane garbage this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. And you can cast a decisive vote for Maine Public Radio by supporting us financially. The news is important to follow these days, and we're committed to continue our one-day and one-day-only fundraiser campaign, Super Thursday, November 2nd. If you already support Maine Public Radio, thank you. If not, you can make a one-time annual gift or make an ongoing evergreen monthly sustaining contribution. It all makes this service possible for you and your community. Call 800-866-1475 or pledge online at mainepublic.org this Super Thursday. Or if it's more convenient, your contributions right now will count toward our Super Thursday goals. And thank you so much for doing your part to support Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the outlook for U.S.-Cuba relations. With me in the studio, Cristina Escobar. She's an anchor person, a journalist at Cuba's state television network. On the line with us from Miami, Richard Blanco, a poet, author, speaker, and Cuban-American who is usually here in Maine, but teaching in Miami right now. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Alan Wells, a professor of history at Bowdoin College, who specializes in Latin American studies. Professor Wells, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to ask you to describe from your perspective the current situation in Cuban-American relations. I think that a lot of people are categorizing it as disintegrating, deteriorating. Do you agree?
I think that, I mean, I've been listening a little bit, but I just got out of class, so I'm sort of catching up on the conversation with Cristina and Richard, but so I don't want to step on what they said, but I think deteriorating might be a little strong. I think my sense is that already there was concern even before the Trump administration announced its policies about which way it would go and whether or not it would attempt to roll back. So things have been in a very tentative or delayed status even before the last spring's announcement. So, you know, it's there's a lot of watchful waiting going on among U.S. companies, I think. And of course, travelers now are concerned about whether or not they'll be able to go and what trips they could go on and what categories, et cetera. So people are trying to figure it out. I think we're all in the same boat here, Jennifer.
The debate, Professor Wells, and I'd like to have Cristina and Richard join in, too, about this part of the conversation. The debate that's going on even within our country, Cristina mentioned the Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and Donald Trump versus those in the country who want to see greater and more meaningful relations. What does this debate in the U.S. really reflect? Is it electoral politics, anti-communism, something else?
Well, I mean, I think it reflects a level of distrust which has existed between the two countries, you know, dating back to 1959. for those, you know, the advocates who want a more open policy to Cuba have said that the policy of the embargo of chilled relations between the two countries have failed, and it's time to try something different, to work with the Cuban people, to try to open up Cuba, to do the kinds of things that the Obama administration had mapped out when it started to renew relations. Of course, others feel that, you know, that the old policy was the correct one, and they, if not, want to go back to something like that. They want to be very careful and deliberate about what changes will be happening.
Christy, did you agree to with the distress?
I think that's an interesting question, because it's definitely not an election favor being returned, what Trump did. In numbers, although he might say that, and he said that he was returning the favor to the Cuban-American community, the number says that. Hillary Clinton won. Obama won twice in South Florida, in these communities. So it's not that sense. Of course, there's a strong group, a stronger, richer, more established groups of Cuban-Americans that believe, like Marco Rubio, Isparo is a voice of that group. But in vast numbers, through the vast majority of the Cuban-American community, believe that the embargo should be lifted, believe that the U.S. should have a more healthy relation with Cuba. I think this is a reflection of anti-communism. I do believe that, although Cuba doesn't even believe that it's building communism anymore. Is a reflection of a rejection to a perspective of sovereignty that Cuba defends. Okay, we're going to do what we want to do, and we won't let the political influences of or the perspective that Cuba should be like a mirror of the U.S. in a different context, with a different history. That idea that we want to be different is unacceptable for some groups of power here in the U.S. And the idea that Cuba gives an example to other countries. An example that the let's say the hardcore of the extreme right groups here in the U.S. doesn't like, and I think there's a combination of all of this, and of course the push of these groups that still see benefit in the platform of being against Cuba, the industry of being against Cuba, which means, by the way, also money and also protagonism politically speaking.
Richard, thoughts?
I was going to say, Alan, Christina and I were also talking about equivalent sort of counterpart generations and the differences in the generations in terms of perspectives and viewpoints and whatnot. And it occurs to me just sitting here that, you know, Trump generationally does belong to that old, even though he's not Cuban American, obviously, does belong to that older kind of mistrust and fear-based and anti-communism generation. So I'm guessing, and I think like Christina said, it's more complex than just one thing, but I think that's part of it, of just reverting back to the old, the tendency to just fall back into that. I want to bring up, though, a little bit of the whole thing with the Sonic and everything that was going on, and which, as Christina was saying, you know, was explaining, you know, to me, of course, it's hard to put, nobody knows what's going on, right? Exactly. And again, as a middle generation, as a bridge generation, I kind of see both halves. So I tend to be very skeptical in my own way about the Cuban government, but I got to say, this just doesn't make any sense. It's like it would be the Cuban government, because they'd be shooting themselves in the foot. Like I said, when I went in July, there was just, you know, I saw cranes going up in Havana for the first time. They're building hotels for the first time in 30 years that I've been going to Cuba. It just doesn't make sense. And it's kind of like very perplexing. And tragic in a way, because it seemed like, regardless of Trump, actually, because with Trump, actually, his initial pulling back of things wasn't as severe as we had expected. But this sort of put the nail in the coffin. Well, not the nail in the coffin, but it sort of really aggravated and maybe gave people an excuse to do what, like, you know, the right, extreme right, to do exactly what they wanted to do. But now there's this perfect excuse. But I'm just perplexed. I can't, you know, I mean, I wish I could get to the bottom of it. It just doesn't make sense. And so there's theories, yeah, right, that it's a rogue part of the government, that it's a third, that it's Russia or China that wants to benefit from the demise of this relationship with Cuba and the U.S. So anyway, you know, because that's really what's precipitated this next sort of fall, right?
Yeah, and it really plays into this narrative of distrust that I raised earlier. You know, I mean, people are thinking along those lines. And so, you know, there are so many theories floating, like you say, Richard, of, you know, who's behind this and who benefits and who doesn't. And there are really no good answers to this. But the bottom line is that the repercussions are really significant. You know, if anything, it's going to, until they can get to the bottom of it, you would think it would just harden those kind of attitudes.
Alan Wells, I know you need to leave and go back to class, but I was just wondering, before we say goodbye, I wanted to see, do you have any final thoughts or a question for Christina Escobar? I have a feeling you don't get to talk to her every day.
Yeah, exactly. I would love to hear a little bit. I mean, we understand that the Cuban people are very much in favor of the normalization process. But I wonder about hardliners, and maybe you talked about this before I got on the phone, so I apologize, but I would love to hear a little bit about, you know, how, you know, are they concerned about the process of reform? Are they resistant to it? You know, we have hardliners in this country, and there are hardliners there who maybe are wary of opening relations and getting drowned in a sea of U.S. investment. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
There's a discussion on Cuba, not because there's only one party, that doesn't mean everyone thinks the same. And there's an internal discussion, but I believe that the side of opening up economy, giving room to private initiative, giving the Americans opportunity to also be part of this opening up of the economy, this side won in that discussion. And I think they've proved that it was right to make the decision that we are not less we're not less Cubans or independents because we talked to an American president, because we received an American president. We're better because we were able to have him over and give him welcome. We do have hardliners. We do have people that believe there's a lot of risk in between, but they do not prevail anymore. And my generation is very clear. There's a consensus that we need to improve the economic conditions so people will stop leaving Cuba. And they stay in, and to keep them in, it's important to take advantage of any opportunity that we have, of course, respecting our principles, our independence, our sovereignty, for which we have paid a high price. And there's a common understanding on that. And the perspective that probably today the worst problems that Cuba has doesn't come from the U.S. The worst challenges needs to be faced by ourselves.
Alan Wells, thanks for joining us. Go teach class. Alan Wells is Roger Howell, Jr., professor of history at Bowdoin College, who specializes in Latin American studies. We do almost need to go to another break, and I promise those of you who are holding on the phone, we'll get to you after that. But Christina, my understanding is that your leader, Raul Castro, has said that he will step down next year. What happens then?
That's a very good question. Well, there's going to be elections. Probably one of the most, let's say, known or groomed figures is the first vice president of the country. His name is Miguel Díaz-Canel Bermúdez, a very smart, interesting, open-minded man from a different generation. I won't tell you what I think or what I believe might happen. I'm telling you what won't happen. No one from the family of Raúl Castro will step in as president or leader of the country. No one from that generation will. So there's a lot of uncertainty. We don't know how that's going to happen. We don't know yet if, for example, this person will have an opponent, someone that will run against him. We don't know that yet because the election system is going to change in Cuba. There's a discussion for that right now. But what I do know that there's a lot of opportunity coming up because of this. A lot of uncertainty. We don't know how it's not to have a war hero like Fidel or Raul leading the country. There's going to be a lot of uncertainty. And we need to reinvent our political evolution because of this. You know why? I wonder how this next person is going to campaign, how this next person is going to be known, how we're going to create a credibility and a legitimacy towards this next person. We don't know how we're going to do that, but we have to. And we need good media, a strong public media, capable professionals to do it. And I do believe, although there's a lot of questions, there's a lot of opportunities, and we're stronger than sometimes we believe we are.
What a great time to be a journalist in Cuba.
Very much, very much. Very exciting.
And Richard Blanco, I want to ask you before we go to a break about you recently met with a delegation that traveled to Cuba, an LGBT delegation. What do you know about changes in Cuba for the LGBTQ community?
That's part of what the delegate, I wish I could have joined them, but I had to, I also
teach.
Had to go teach classes. at FIU where I'm at right now, Florida International University. I think there's, it's part of sort of another layer of conversation. And it was Representative Takano was with the delegation. And part of what they're trying to do is just have a conversation and see how they can learn from each other. The LGBT movement, obviously, in the United States has a few more years on it, so to speak. So that's part of what the delegation is trying to do. Of course, there's different challenges because culturally, homophobias are different. There's all sorts of other layers of stuff going on. And I was trying to shed some light on that for them. But at the end of the day, it seems Cuba is pushing forward on sort of leading with Raul's daughter. I forget. Cristina.
Mariela Castro.
I forget her first name all the time. Mariela Castro, right, who's a big advocate for LGBT, right? So it's part of, again, like Cristina's saying, a country that's just evolving and thinking about itself in new ways and trying to figure it out. And the delegation was in the way there to lend a hand in the ways that other organizations and other delegations have done to exchange ideas, information, and shake hands, so to speak.
Well, before we take a quick break, a word about tomorrow's program. We are going to be talking with NPR's Corey Flintoff, who's been a radio journalist for 40 years, most recently as NPR's Moscow correspondent. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking with Cristina Escobar and Richard Blanco about Cuba. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco, and the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs at Colby College, inspiring active citizenship in the world of public affairs.
Intelligence Squared U.S., where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues. The next topic up for debate is Western democracy threatening suicide.
People sometimes don't desire democracy. They prefer something else. They prefer nationalism. They prefer sometimes war.
Our politicians work for us, not the other way around.
That conversation coming up at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling.
On the next Fresh Air, Farhad Manju, who has covered the tech world for 20 years, tells us why he thinks technology has crossed over to the dark side. He's been writing a series for the New York Times about what he calls the Frightful Five: Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Microsoft. But he admits he's outfitted his home with every tech gadget available. Join us.
That's on Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the situation in Cuba and U.S.-Cuba relations. Joining me today, Cristina Escobar. She's a TV anchorwoman in Cuba. And Richard Blanco is on the line with us, a Cuban-American as well as poet and author and Maine resident. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to David, who's calling from Camden. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hello, Jennifer. It's an interesting topic you're dealing with today. I spent almost 3 years in Cuba trying to establish a photography, film, and journalism school. And I dealt with a lot of the bureaucracy and the Communist Party and the people on the street. Love the country and understand the problems it's facing now. I just finished a book on those 3 years of being in Cuba called A Maine Yankee in Communist Cuba Flying Under Castro's Radar.
David, what years were you there?
1999, 2000, 2001, and 2002, before we got kicked out.
All right. Do you have a question for Cristina Escobar or Richard Blanco?
Cristina, I'm still in touch with a number of my Cuban associates down there. And those that have left and come to the States feel free to criticize the government more than the people who are still living there. But one of the comments that I received from one of the bureaucrats was, we don't need no American imperialists coming down here telling us what to do. And that was eventually that they thought I was CIA and secretly bringing in journalists. That was probably the prime reasons that we had our permission terminated to bring American photographers and journalists down to Cuba. The feeling of the Cuban ruling class against the American imperialists still exists, does it?
I would say more moderate than that experience that you have, which I totally understand, and I totally believe that might have happened to you. And we leave that idea of an American coming in. Sometimes we make it as a personal or individual issue when it's a more broader idea. The fear of that American coming over to colonize you, it's part of our common sense that it's not a good thing. That's why it's part of the distrust that we've been talking about. But I think it's much more different now. I have the situation has changed. It's been almost 20 years since that happened to you. So it's much more different. For example, now we have an international school of photography, which is independent from the state. I've talked to them several times. And they are like an NGO working inside Cuba. And that's an example of how things are changing. Unfortunately, we do have people that still believe like that and are reluctant to give, for example, permissions or licenses to an American photographer to be in Cuba without not being part of a media, established media with correspondence in Cuba. But David, I'm telling you, the situation that you lived, although it did happen, is quite different now. That's my impression, and I'm very related to that world as a journalist in TV.
David, thanks for your call. We're going to go to South Portland and Bob. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment. Our daughter is currently doing a semester abroad. She's a college student in Cuba, and she is finding the Cuban people in society to be open, very friendly. And the country is just absolutely beautiful. We were hoping to be able to go to Cuba this semester and join her, but we were unable to because of the change in the travel regulations. I also grew up in South Florida with first-generation Cuban refugees. I think I'm hoping that their thoughts and feelings toward the Cuban administration can be more open and be changing. I just think it's tragic that the Trump administration is going back to outdated Cold War ideologies. I think as Americans, we need to do everything we can to resist and turn back the current administration's backward destructive policies. I think that through openness and dialogue, travel back and forth is the way that change happens, free exchange ideas. And I think that this just puts a clamp on the ability of both nations to do that. So that's my comment.
All right. Thanks, Bob. And I suspect, Richard Blanco, that you're saying, yep.
Yeah, a couple things about that. Is that, again, getting back to the generational issues, and I don't know if I stole this from somebody, but the generation that caused the problem usually can't fix it. and that's true in many respects and in many different contexts. But I think that's part of what we're seeing. As Cristina echoed, there is a very public face that portrays Cuban Americans. It's these completely hardliners who of one opinion, of one monolithic opinion. And I think the statistics show otherwise, that people are much more gray when it comes to Cuba and much more open to people to people. A couple other things. I think I am echoing back to, I think the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba was so tender, so tierna, that I'm thinking back. Remember when I think it was the U.S. got caught spying on Germany with Merkel or some kind of tapes or something like that, and as adults and countries that sort of respected each other, there was a conversation, someone apologized and whatnot, and the matter was over, right? But this moment again gave back an excuse to sort of go to mistrust instead of continuing the relationship in good faith. I think there's been a lot of changes, as we've been talking about, throughout the generations. It's just really a weird time to see Cuba, you know, almost, you know, it's like, it, I think it's more dramatic because it was sort of like we were going uphill in that relationship and then suddenly there's this cliff. And it's just so, so tender of a relationship that everything matters and is, you know, magnified. So, yeah.
Bob, thanks for your call. We'll go to Portland and Johnny. Hi, Johnny. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I was just calling because, and I don't want this to be like a non sequitur, but I earlier in the conversation, you were talking about, you know, visits to Cuba starting in the 70s. Refugees and whatnot from Cuba. But I had an interesting experience in the 90s living in the Northwest where there were these sort of, activists going up to Canada and then flying down to Cuba during like the harvest season for tobacco.
Mm-hmm. Christina, do you know about that?
No, but I imagine that might happen.
Yeah. And I just thought like it would just add to like, you know, the statement that, you know, there's been American, you know, visitation, I guess, to Cuba. In addition to just, you know, you know, refugees and whatnot, but just like activism style, I guess.
Johnny, thanks for your help.
I forget.
Go ahead, Richard.
There is a time, and I forget, I think there was even a self-named group that, and it's interesting because it makes it, the story of U.S. and Cuba is pretty complex, but there's even that facet, right? Some of the children of exiles who became or believed in pretty left of center ideas actually rejected some of, you know, the reasons they were here in this country, and also thought they wanted to reclaim their Cuban heritage because there was an emptiness and a void, and some of them went to help with the harvest and all this stuff. So it's interesting. It's like, there's so many facets to any history, right? And this is one piece of that as well. And so that was part. I think that's what he was referring to.
Uh-huh.
But I want to, yeah, the relationship again. I started in the late 70s, and it was. It was predominantly a family. I've been able to go to Cuba because I have family there. The rules have changed depending on who's on the White House because the embargo as an act is up to the interpretation of what that means is up to the executive branch. That's why the rules always keep on changing. You see harder, more restrictions, obviously, when there's a Republican in the White House, more opening up when there's a Democrat in the White House. So the idea of travel has been, you know, has been dialed up and dialed down. But still, you know, there is this prevalent sense in America that nobody has gone to Cuba since 1959, right? And believe me, if you wanted to go to Cuba, you could go to Cuba. there's ways to get there, right?
Yeah.
So that's part of it. But I also wanted to echo something generationally that Christina was saying in regard to the last caller, too, and his experience, which, like you, Christina, I totally believe happened, right? And I can say that even since I was going in 1979, I haven't had a terrible experience, but certainly the attitude of just people on the street, people in positions of service or of, you know, the airport, or has really radically changed. I mean, there was a time in Cuba where it was much more tense. In the first, you know, when I first went in 94, it was pretty tense. I mean, there was a certain still sort of mistrust on both sides, right? So So that's evolved a little bit too, I think. I see that change a lot.
Richard, thanks. And Johnny, thanks for your call. Christina, you had a question for Richard, don't you?
Yeah, but I was just thinking. No, it's a request, a wish, a dream. And I, as we've, I mean, I knew it, but now discovered and confirmed how much we share in this fight for bringing together our two countries. I challenge a little bit, allow me to challenge a little bit the perspective of that a generation can't fix the problem that created, because I see a young Marco Rubio saying so many things like he's living in the 60s, and I saw Raul Castro shaking Obama's hand. And I question really if it's up to the generation or the role of the people that have in their particular moments. And my hope, even in these worst times that we're living now between our two countries because of the current policy of the administration of Donald Trump, my hope is towards people like you, like Cuba One, towards Cuban Americans, decent people that love Cuba, and decent Americans that understand that being enemies doesn't bring anything good to neither country, to either countries. And that's my petition, my request to you as a patriot, as I know you are, to be part of this fight, that you're not alone, that you don't only have the people beside you there in Miami or here in Maine, but you have people in Cuba that also wants the two countries to be friends, to be together and help each other.
Well, thank you, Christina. I've hearing you speak has just been a wonderful treat, and really, yeah, I feel we're connecting on many, many levels. And I've slowly, you know, especially the last few years, I really actually do feel strongly and meeting faces and people in Cuba that are my counterparts, and it's been wonderful and a wonderful experience. And now I have you in that realm as well. And you're right. I think that you can't always, you know, nothing is ever black and white, and you can't always divide things around generational lines. And there's a good point, like some of the, which is to me sometimes very frustrating, to especially when you see the younger generation sort of talking about a thing that, you know, in a sense that they can't even really own, because at least if they were older generation, I could understand their perspective and respect it a little bit more. But to sort of almost appropriate something that you didn't experience, and so when you see that in younger generations, it's particularly upsetting, right? Because they're talking about something that I don't think they even have emotional authority to talk about, and so you're right. And then the older generations, there's always people that break through, outliers or moments where people do change, and there's a new conversation. And I think we've seen that throughout history. And I think that's what we can hope for, that that everyone sort of meets at the human level and recognizes our common and shared humanity. And the rest can be worked out, hopefully.
Well, Richard Blanco, those are beautiful last words. I have to cut you off. Richard Blanco, Cuban-American poet, right. Author, as well as a public speaker and civil engineer. Christina Escobar, leading journalist on Cuba's statewide television network. What a treat to have both of you with us today. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Cindy Hahn answered your calls. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Corey Flintoff. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.